remember when that article came out, and I actually went on record because it was right in the middle of my time with Toyota, which I'll talk about a bit. I went on record internally in classes that I was teaching because I was attached to the University of Toyota, saying, yeah, something can stop Toyota. Toyota. And I didn't know how self-fulfilling prophecy I was. Okay, so I didn't know exactly what I was going to talk about until I heard Mary call. And she's given me a nice entree point to what I'd like to share with you today. The underlying theme of her talk was innovation, which is my bailiwick. It's my backyard. It's what I live for ideas. I'm an idea person. I'm often accused by my wife of being too inside my head. But that's, you know, ideas being the lifeblood of innovation. I thought, well, let's talk about that a bit, and then we'll overlay a little bit of the Toyota thing, tease out some context here. Where do I mean when I talk about an elegant solution, and see if I can weave together in 20 minutes, something that makes sense in context of storytelling. Raise your hand if you consider yourself a good problem solver. Yeah, I mean, we solve problems all day long. But before you walked in here at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, you probably already solved 50 problems, right? What kind of problems were there? How to find a building, figure us out of town, or what am I going to wear? Did I wear it yesterday? Is it going to be tall, rounding, bent? Those kinds of questions. Raise your hand if you consider yourself a good learner. Yeah, okay, so both, everybody's raising their hand. Well, here's the test. Raise your hand if you consider yourself a true innovator. Somewhat less, but that's good. That's good. I do this in large audiences, and about the same number of hands in a 1,000-person audience. It's somewhat disturbing to me. Why didn't all the hands go up when I asked that question? And I think it's because we define innovation in an incorrect way. When we hear the word innovation, we think innovations. We think of gadgets and gizmos and iPads and iPhones, right? We don't think about the process, the human-centered process of innovation. But I'm here to tell you that the underlying creative and iterative loop behind problem-solving and learning in terms of creating new knowledge through experimentation, not just acquiring knowledge from others in this fashion, and innovation is one and the same. It's one and the same. And the reason I want to talk about that is because what if you are working in an organization where you don't have a manager who gives you that 15% of time? You know, if you believe what the Gallup organization says, less than 1% of people holding the title of manager actually have what they call the strengths and talents to draw out the potential in people in much the way that Mary laid out. Quite frankly, what do you do if you've got a manager who's less than forthcoming, doesn't say go forth and have a project of passion, doesn't give you the 15% of the time? As a matter of fact, they're a bad boss. What do you do if you've got a bad boss? And you know, because a lot of people leave their jobs not because of money, but because of their manager. My ideas don't get heard. They don't surface. I've got a lot of great ideas. And when they do get surfaced, by gosh, he steals them. Or she steals them. What do you do? So I want to share with you a few stories that help answer that question, because it's a very real and very practical question to ask and answer. The first story begins back in the Renaissance. How many of you know the backstory of how Michelangelo came to paint the Sistine Chapel? Okay. It's a fairly fascinating story of how to manage a bad boss. You see, the Pope had, retained Michelangelo to do something with the Sistine Chapel, and he had promised him 40 statues of marble. And Michelangelo spent a year in the Italian hills getting these blocks of marble. It was going to be his legacy to the chapel, to the world, really. Well, the Pope's advisors thought that would give Michelangelo a little bit too much power, a little bit too much access to the Pope. And they convinced the Pope to have Michelangelo not do the statues, but to actually paint. And painting was not his thing. That was not his forte. And not just paint, but paint using fresco. the Sistine Chapel. He did not like fresco. He was not a painter. But if he refused, he'd be out of a job, number one, and probably we would not know of him as an artist. But he had a competitor, Raphael, an up-and-coming painter. If he didn't take the job, the work would go to Raphael. So what does he do? He does what a good innovator does. And he took creative lessons. He decided to reinvent the way fresco was done. And he hung himself upside down for 4 years, right? Refused all the help, and the Pope's advisors wanted to get him all the help that he needed. Right? And he refused all that, built all the scaffolding, hung upside down, and painted for 4 years, and you know, so the rest is history. But he had a bad boss. He had a bad boss. He had to manage his boss. Right? That's story number one. And I'll synthesize the lesson there. But then fast forward to the early 1990s, when a young man by the name of Thornton Oxnard, he's a friend of mine, graduated Columbia University in New York City with a double major in business, Columbia Business School, MBA, pretty top school, and Japan Studies. And Thor decides that what he wants to do is to move to Japan and work for Toyota. And, you know, you get out with a degree from Columbia, it's a pretty nice ticket. That's a pretty nice ticket. But when he gets to Toyota in Japan, they gave him a very lowly job. Parts processor. Processor, right? And he takes the obligatory job, and he takes the obligatory training. He's put him in the factory to learn the Toyota production system. They teach him Kaizen, which is continuous improvement, and the problem-solving methodology underlying that, as every employee does. And then they stick him in a job, in a cubicle. And I don't know if you've ever been to Japan and seen their working conditions, but it is very Spartan. Right? And so he goes to work, shuffling his paper, and he's vastly underutilized. This is way beneath his intellectual prowess, way beneath his talent and capability, way beneath his intellect. What's his patience? Patience for a month. And he goes to his boss, his manager, his supervisor, and he says, I can do more work. Give me more work. I'm not asking for a raise. I'm not asking for a new title. Give me more to do. And typical Japanese fashion, there's not really a response given. Acknowledgement of Thor's dissatisfaction, if you will, or goes back to work and waits patiently for another month. And he makes a second trip to his manager's office, and he says, I'm truly serious. I know it sounds wacky, but I do want more work to do. Please give me some more assignments. And his manager nods, sends Thor back to work again. Another month passes, and this time he's getting a little frustrated. There is nothing coming his way in terms of more assignments, more work to do. He makes a third trip to his manager's office, and this time his manager says, in effect, Thor, we have trained you in the Toyota production system. We have trained you how to solve problems. The rest is up to you. And here are the words. Go dig your own job. Go dig your own job. This became a story throughout Toyota that was told, and it continues to be sold. Go dig your own job. Well, what does that mean? When someone tells you, go dig your own job, what the heck does that mean? I get to create my own job? No. I don't get a new job title. I have to figure out how to dig my job. What is he telling me to do? Well, it immediately put Thor in a question-asking frame of mind. In order for me to dig my own job, what essentially I need to do is to figure out how I, given my talents, given my skills, given my background, how do I add value in this parts, paper, you know, supply processing job? And so he started casting about the organization. He started figuring out how money flowed in and out of his particular part of the world. He started asking people, seeing the other units, seeing the other business units and departments, and he figured out how he, in his little world, fit into the broader picture of things, and lo and behold, he discovered that there was a problem. And the problem was that there was not so great communication. There was a rather contentious relationship between General Motors and Toyota. Go figure. But it had to do with a specific operation. You see, and so just recently, General Motors and Toyota had a joint venture in Northern California. It was called New United Motor Manufacturing, Inc. They were building GM cars and they were building Toyota cars. The operation was never profitable, but that's another story. They had contentious communication around the parts. And why was it contentious? Well, that was the question that Thor began to ask, because he had been trained in problem solving and a very simple technique called the five whys, which allows you to get down to the root cause of a problem in many different domains, even in your personal life. You can figure out your personal cause and purpose in life by simply starting with your job description and digging down to figure out exactly how you add value to others. So he said, well, why is there this disharmony between GM and Toyota? Well, the first answer was because they didn't have a contract. They didn't have a contract. Well, why didn't they have a contract? Well, because they couldn't agree to terms. And he kept digging. Why couldn't they agree to terms? Well, at the heart of all of this problem was because they spoke different languages. One spoke Japanese and one spoke English. Well, guess what? In his advanced degree in Japan studies, he was a fluent speaker of Japanese. He discovered a way to act as a liaison between the two parties. A contract was crafted, and it actually became the launching point for one of Toyota's most successful lines of business, which was their parts supply business, their global parts supply business, within his own job. He's now a very highly ranked strategic planning manager here in the United States, but it sprang from digging his own job. He dug his own job just the way Michelangelo dug his own job. And the third story actually relates to someone who's got his name on the car, Akio Toyota. Maybe you watched the congressional hearings just recently where Akio Toyota was in front of Congress sort of stumbling through some answers to some very, very difficult questions. Well, back in the 1980s, he was not the head of Toyota. As a matter of fact, he wasn't even at the managing director level. And now he's the great-grandson of the person who founded Toyota, Sakichi Toyota, back in the days of spinning and weaving, back in the 1800s, early 1900s. He's his great-grandson. Now, you would think that someone who has his name on the building would be able to get his ideas heard. But such is not the case. Such is not the case. As a matter of fact, in the mid-1900s, Akio has had a history of disturbing the elders. The 37 or so directors of Toyota move rather slowly. Now, sometimes that can be good, and recently it's shown to be rather bad. But he was educated here in the West, and he had a different notion of how operations should go. They should move a little bit quicker, we should take quicker action, and we should be at the forefront of new technology. Well, one of the new technologies that he was in favor of was the World Wide Web. And he had run across a manager of Microsoft in the mid-1990s and thought that there might be something to this internet kind of thing. And the question that he teed up was, well, is there a way that we can actually benefit our customers by allowing them to see through this mechanism called the World Wide Web their car being repaired all the way through the process in Japan? And to a person, he was opposed. As a matter of fact, he was denied, and that was his project, but they gave him a very small budget, and they really put him in a box. He was not allowed to advertise his concept, which he called Gazoo.com. Gazoo.com. As a matter of fact, he could not do any advertising, no PR, nothing on radio, nothing on TV, couldn't even use the internet. They wouldn't allow this idea to see the light of day, but there was a loophole. What they didn't say was that you couldn't put posters up in the trains and subways. And that's what he did. He put little posters up in the trains and subways in Tokyo, advertising Gazoo.com. It is now a multi-billion dollar line of business. You can make travel arrangements. There are kiosks in Japan that you can do your banking, you can do your travel arrangements. It is a huge line of business, and it actually, by fighting the system in that way and digging his own job, He became managing director, and he just made president last year. I'm not sure that he'd be happy about that right now. But, well, take those three stories, and sure enough, what's the lesson there? Well, the lesson is this. When it comes to innovation and problem solving and learning, yes, they're all one and the same in terms of the thinking process, but here it is. Rarely in large organizations are we granted the creative license to do innovative work. Generally speaking, it's reserved for the product developers, the R&D folks, and maybe the marketing and advertising folks, because they're all creative, right? They're the right brainers. But creative license has to be taken. It has to be taken. You do have to dig your own job. And within the confines of your job responsibility and the way it's been laid out, you have got to find a way to sculpt your work so that you add value for your customers, whether they're internal, whether they're external. And that, I think, is an important lesson through a couple of stories, because I think that's the air that most of us breathe in large organizations. I got to work with Toyota merely by fluke, merely by accident. It was 1998, and it was just before Christmas, and I got a very strange phone call. You see, I graduated from the Wharton MBA school in 1985 and immediately became an independent contractor. I have never, ever, ever held a real job. But I got this phone call just before Christmas in 1998, and it went something like this. Mr. May, my name is Michael Morrison. I'm the dean of something called the University of Toyota. It's part of a 7-point new era strategy here at Toyota. It's a fully endowed cost center, $45 million, to help move the business forward in some way. Quite frankly, we don't know exactly how to do that. We're going to have an offsite after the new year. We're going to try and bring everyone that's been selected to be part of this, from human resources, from training, from strategic planning, together to try and figure out who we want to be when we grow up. We're looking for the very best facilitator we can possibly find to help us do that. Unfortunately, he's not available. Swear to God. We hear you might be. That became the serendipitous event that allowed me to stay fully retained with this organization for 8 years. It was a life-changing experience, and some of the lessons that I learned there I've captured in a couple of books. But one of them is that the notion, and I think part of the reason, too, that not everyone raised their hands when I said, are you an innovator, is this definition of innovation. Let me give you one that's rather accessible, and it comes from the founder of a company called JetBlue. David Yeoman is his name. And it's very simply this. Because if you were to look up innovation, like if you were to go to Amazon and plug in innovation, you'd get 100,000 titles. And many of them academic, and many of them long-winded. Everyone's got a different take on what innovation is. But here's a dirt simple definition. And it will allow you to raise your hand when I ask you the question again here in a minute. Innovation is trying to figure out a way to do something better than it's ever been done before. Figuring out a way to do something better than it's ever been done before. Quite simply that. Whether you look at big ideas, radical disruptive ideas, whether you look at tiny shop floor incremental ideas, isn't it just trying to get something a little bit better than it was before, or maybe a lot better, but it's getting better, and that's the notion. And there was this notion of pursuit of perfection, that there is no limit on getting better. So let me ask you this. If you raise your hand to consider yourself an innovator. Yeah, there we go. Now, I left in 2006, and that's obviously when all the bad stuff started. But it was an 8-year stint, and it really radically changed how I view the world. They were at one time implementing roughly 1 million ideas a year. 1 year, there was 3 million ideas. And the reason that I knew that there were this many ideas is because I could find them on a sheet of paper. It was in Japan, it's called a Kaizen newspaper. It was the story of an idea. At a certain level, every idea is put on an A3 size sheet of paper. Right? It's generally speaking hand sketched. But it's the story of a team, it's the story of a problem, it's how a problem was solved, and the story of an experiment that was run. Not all those ideas are adopted, but when you can get people coming in the door every day, especially in a factory setting, to not just do the work, but to improve the work on a daily basis, you actually do become unstoppable. Now, unfortunately, lately, you can get too unstoppable, as we're finding out. You can grow too fast. You can get different people coming into the organization that have a different way of viewing things. Certain core values get diluted, and lo and behold, you wake up the next day, and in a matter of 3 or 4 months, your world is upside down. And that, I think, is what has happened at Toyota. We don't know exactly what's going on there. The people that I know that are still in the organization are scratching their heads the way I am. You know, what's going on? I don't know. Is this the organization that I've been with for 20 years? What is going on here? How could this possibly happen? We still are operating the same way. We've been sort of blindsided by some of this. We can't replicate these problems. They're good problem solvers. When you're implementing a million ideas a year, you're pretty darn good at solving problems. And they can't solve this one. They can't solve this one. So anyway, the takeaway is that through these stories, my lesson is just quite simply this. Very rarely do you get creative license granted. You've got to do what every good innovator does and every inventor does. Take that creative license. Use the edge of the canvas. Right? Sting doesn't say, oh my gosh, I need a ninth note. Right? You got 8 notes. You can write a new song. The writer doesn't say, oh my gosh, 26 letters in the alphabet, I need another one. I can't write this story if I have more. Sort of a subtractive process if you think about it. And I'll leave you with my definition of what elegance and an elegant solution is, because it was a word that had weight there at Toyota. As a matter of fact, the individual Mike Morrison, who was my primary client, used to say, people don't want our products and services, they want solutions to problems. When it comes to solutions, simple is better, elegant is better still. I never really understood what that meant, because there really wasn't a good definition of it. I knew what it didn't mean. I knew what it wasn't. Because I could see which ideas got killed and rejected. Anything that was confusing, complicated, wasteful, excessive, harmful, hazardous, unnatural, and ugly was not considered a good solution. Anything elegant. That allowed me to sort of start thinking about, well, what is elegance? And then I'll leave you this final story. My life changed in 2003. Nothing to do with that article. But I read another article. It was actually an op-ed piece. And it was in USA Today. And it was written by a guy by the name of Jim Collins. Ring a bell? He wrote an article, an op-ed piece in USA Today in the forum section, December 30th, 2003. And at that time, I was really, truly struggling on what I was trying to advise Toyota to do. I was really up against, well, I didn't have an elegant solution to this project that I was assigned to, this problem I was trying to solve, which was, how do we get these kinds of this thinking into the knowledge side of business. And I was up against a brick wall, and I read this article. And the article was called, or the op-ed was called, Best New Year's Resolution, a Stop Doing List. A Stop Doing List. And in that article, he told the story of how he left Stanford Business School and began work at Hewlett-Packard as a young manager. And he was fast-tracking up the hierarchy of Hewlett-Packard, as an MBA is wont to do. Right? And he made a trip back to Stanford to visit one of his favorite classes. It was called Personal Creativity in Business. And his professor, it was taught by two professors, Mark Bolway and Rochelle Myers, and she flew out in that and she said, I know you pretty well. I spent a lot of time here. I think you're going down the wrong path. Allow me to give you an exercise so that you can rethink exactly what you're doing. Imagine that you have inherited $20 million free and clear, yet you have only 10 years left to live. What would you do, and more specifically, what would you stop doing? Guess what was at the top of the list of what he would stop doing?
His job.
He realized that truly he hated his job. What really lit his fire internally was research and writing and digging into organizations. And he quit his job. And he camped out on Peter Drucker's doorstep in Claremont, California, because that was sort of the model of what he wanted to do. And he modeled his life and his career after Peter Drucker. Probably is considered by many to be the new Drucker in many regards. But he recommended a stop doing list, which is to say, he begins his entire year when he set New Year's resolutions. Which is what those are the big to-do lists, right? Mm-hmm. Things we're going to do. And isn't it funny how by January 17th, you've forgotten all of them, right? He says, every time you come up with a to-do list, come up with a stop-doing list. And here's how you do it. Come up with your great list of objectives and goals and things that you want to do, and prioritize it, in a thoughtful way, then knock out the bottom 20%. forever. Just forget about it forever. That's a very, very difficult thing to do. But reading that article, reading that op-ed, changed my perspective on everything. Because he ends the essay by saying, a great piece of art is defined not just by what's in the final rendering, but what is not. Mm-hmm. What has taken years and many, many dollars of investment to cut out that which doesn't fit, be it a life, be it a book, be it a symphony, be an idea. And all of a sudden, it was as if someone had taken a hammer and hit me over the head. Because all of a sudden, I began to look at not what to do, but what to not do, what to stop doing. And that's where the notion of elegance really started to sink home with me. Because elegance in my world, the way I define it, because if you look in the dictionary, you can't find elegant solution. Fine. Okay? They say, it sort of says, see elegance. And when you go to elegance, the definition is more of a description rather than a definition. It's something like marked by concision and clever incisiveness, as in an elegant solution. That really doesn't help. Right? But this notion of stop doing and cutting out and removing subtraction really is at the heart of what I consider elegance. An elegant solution is one that achieves the maximum effect with a maximum impact through the minimum means. And elegance in any domain, I think, is marked by two characteristics that are sometimes contradictory, but it's the unique pairing of extreme simplicity and surprising impact. So maximum effect through minimum means, surprising impact, extreme simplicity. And I've traveled the world looking for ideas that are subtractive that way, where something has been removed and greater impact because of it. But it all started at Toyota, in this organization that right now is having great difficulty. And if you saw the news yesterday, they've had to do a lot of stop doing. Right? Stop producing, stop selling. It's going over to the Lexus brand right now. How many people drive Toyota, Lexus, or Zion? Yeah. It's not a good thing right now. But anyway, I think I've gone over my 20 minutes, so let me stop it there. And if that provoked any kind of thought, question, response, play it on.
I had the pleasure of meeting Mike Morrison and attending the university as an inspiration for our company, and it was really the most inspiring corporate university I've ever seen. And I've been worried with all that's going on, what's happening there? Are they choosing to continue to learn, or all of a sudden do those ideas and inspirations and the way they do business, does that get set aside in times of crisis?
Yeah, it's a good question. Mike Morrison left last year, he retired. I still know a few folks there, and it has unfortunately become less than dynamic, and they've gone back to sort of boilerplate teaching courses. And they're in firefighting mode. Sometimes cost centers and organizations, their visibility to executive levels and strategic planning kinds of things are hinged on who runs that operation. And Mike was a thinker. Right? He and I worked together. He was the big idea guy, and I was the architect. Like, I was the guy that was meant to translate the stuff for the everyman, so we got to do something with it. To do that 30,000-foot view, and I sort of the headlight level view. And when you don't have someone like that, a visionary, things go by the wayside. It's an imperative. Jim Press, who was a big benefactor of ours, left and went to Chrysler, and is probably regretting that decision right now. But, sometimes you get the wrong person in a job, and they say, well, how are you helping me sell cars? And you can't make a real strong case for that in a tangible way. Bad things happen. So it's not the same place, unfortunately. Yeah, it is unfortunate. It is unfortunate.
I want to try and make a connection between what Steve said in his introductory story, a software company that was innovative, bureaucracy developed, it lost its way, and then the CEO went to a whole different model. So he was really implementing the stop doing. What I'm interested in is when you've got a management that's been doing and institutionalizing what they thought was the right thing, how do you open their eyes and consider the question of stop doing or doing something new?
Yeah. Gosh, I wish I had a silver bullet. I don't think that there's an easy answer. I can give you an example at a smaller level of a company that did just that in France, called Bobby, and the CEO came in one day, having just taken the reins as CEO, having been there 25 years, and did exactly what Steve described. He basically, when you have that kind of power, he flipped the switch and said, "Today, you no longer work for me, you work for your customer." And he removed the personnel department, he broke down all of the silos, just as Steve described, and he said, "Go form teams around our primary customers and self-organize." And sometimes it takes that. But when you've got a huge bureaucracy and you've got a very slow-moving organization, you know, for many years, Toyota, for example, was criticized for being so slow. They were slow to adopt new technology. They were slow to do many things, especially internally. I got a feeling right now they're just now getting laptops with CD-ROM drives. But in many respects, they moved very, very slowly and very incrementally, their mantra being bold ideas, careful action. Well, that can come back and haunt you when something that requires pressing action, because if you move slowly in general, you're going to be slow to react to certain problems no matter where they exist. And so it has sort of come back to haunt them right now. And it's in an area that we're all sort of scared of, which is sudden acceleration. My car is out of control. Oh, my gosh. Right? Had it been any other area, we wouldn't be talking about it, and they would be carefully weighing the evidence before they took action. But now, carefully weighing the evidence and being able to scientifically prove what the cause of a problem is hurting them. And it's actually bringing down the organization internally. They're putting new positions in place that aren't really necessary so that it looks like something's being done for the press and for the government. Right, and for the media and the government and the customers, that's the illusion of action. But I think it's just that. It's not really solving anything. So it's a double-edged sword, and unfortunately, they're feeling the other edge of the sword right now, and it's a hard thing. I don't have a quick answer for you.
No, but what you're saying is crisis is an important part of it, or like the French CEO who came in at some point had that opportunity to push the switch.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, though. Toyota was really good at creating a constant sense of crisis. When I was there, my major criticism of them was that they never smiled. You know, they never celebrated. If you met your expectations, that was the expectation. Right? There was no cause for celebration. If you exceeded your expectations, that was a dismal event. You know why? Because that's a gap. I was in team meetings where the expectations, the goals were exceeded. Why is that? Why did you exceed them? Because if you can overshoot something, you can undershoot something. And there's no learning in backslapping. But still, celebrate once in a while. Just meeting me. When they met their sales objectives, I remember standing in this atrium meeting. At the beginning of every year, they had this atrium meeting. And it was a banner sales year. And Jim Press, the first thing out of his mouth was a yabba. We met our sales objectives, great. But guess what? We're below average in customer and sales satisfaction, according to J.D. Power and Associates. And every head in that atrium went. Right? So, the language that we use, the way that we relay messages can really be powerful. But they were always good at creating a burning platform. And the way they did it was not in a negative way, but by setting extremely aggressive goals. Back in 2007, they had a to-do list that was, I thought, outrageous. And we may be seeing the backlash of it right now. They were going to open 3 new plants, a couple in China, 1 here. They were going to improve their operating margins 1 full percent. They were going to sell 9 million more cars. They were going to onboard 3,000 new engineers and 5,000 designers. It was crazy. It was crazy. And Akio Toyota's mission right now is that we grew too fast. But that's how they set a sense of crisis at all times. There was always a burning platform because just as you thought you were going to reach the goal, it moves you in the goal line, right? And you'd always be in that off-balance point. There was never a way to be complacent. They didn't allow it. It constantly set the bar higher. But there's a downside to that. You got to be careful. That's a balancing act. When you've got a whole group of people and everything is consensus, everything is done by consensus and agreement. It's called numawashi. There is not one person, it's not like a charismatic, Bill Ford runs Ford Motor kind of thing, or Mulally runs Ford and says, you're going to go do this. No, everybody has to sort of agree, by committee. And, it's tough to turn the ship around that way. Yes, sir.
So to take a biological level, in evolutionary theory, there's the idea that things go along for long periods of time with incremental change and innovation and variation, and then you get a catastrophic event on a global scale, climate change, an astronomical event, but something that just totally disrupts everything systemically. Punctuated equilibrium. So what does a catastrophe on the scale of the one that Toyota, as an example, is experiencing right now, what opportunities does that potentially present for a really radical transformation?
That's a good question. I would hope that they're actually embracing that question. I'm not sure that they're there yet. I'm not sure that they're doing anything but trying to manage the fire, control the fire right now. But there's a Japanese word, and the symbols, it's a word for crisis, and it's made up basically of characters that are opportunity and danger. So you're absolutely right. I'm not sure that they're seeing the opportunity right now in any other way than to prevent something like this in the future. I have a feeling that what they're doing is going back to the old school. And the old school being the way that you would design a car would be to have many, many physical prototypes and do a lot of testing, not just in software. I would lay my bottom dollar on that much of this is caused by a software glitch that no engineer or designer is in control of. It looks great on the screen, but when the spec gets built by 15 different suppliers and they build on redundant systems, it goes bad. So, they're probably going to go back to the old school where it takes a little bit longer to produce a car. You take a market hit for it by not coming out with new products, but you prevent these kinds of things from ever happening. So that's the opportunity, is to sort of get back to the basics. And maybe the transformation is taking a step back before they start moving forward. And let's get back to what brought us to the party in the first place, right? And let's make sure that we can get stability here, because that's what Toyota is all about. Their strategy in general is all about stability. And if you're hitting golf balls in the fog, there's something wrong. You've got to have a way to have feedback, right? And this is the mirror, this is the feedback, and I got to feel that that's what the opportunity is. So rather than a leap forward, it may actually be a step back in order to move forward.
One question I had is, when you look at this, if you look at the numbers of how many, like using Toyota, how many cars actually have problems versus how many cars they actually produce. So what is the impact nowadays of a problem can be generated, say, on media, through people, through blogs, through any number of things, a problem can be generated almost immediately, incredibly widespread, and the actual truth or whatever you want of it can be debatable, but there's no time frame around that. So what is the impact of that as far as story and narrative for organizations and companies and everything like this, and now it's like that. And it's even like that before you even know that there's anything or you even think of it.
Well, it certainly gives you something to think about for the future. I mean, it's a Twitter world, right? I don't usually read newspapers anymore. You know why? I get more news through online sources and Twitter than I ever. It's old by the time I get the printed piece, right? You can't even call it news anymore. So I don't know what the implications are. I think we're at the forefront of all that. People are trying to sort out, what does this social media world look like? What do we do with it? How do we manage it? How do we exploit it? I have no idea, but it is a fascinating area, and I'm not sure that is what drove a lot of this or not, but it's certainly a byproduct of it, and gosh, it certainly exacerbated the awareness of it. I did a little Twitter survey not too long ago. I wanted to see what the various groups and how they were reacting to this Toyota situation. Now, was it oh my God, disaster? Was it trust in Toyota? Was it a shoulder shrug? And interestingly enough, I only have like, I don't know, 5,000 or 6,000 people that follow me on Twitter, but I got a good response, and it was a third. Right? So now I don't know what you do with that. Right? I mean, it's not like I galvanized anyone. Maybe it should have been two more choices or something. But it was just an interesting thing. But I used it just to gauge what the sentiment was, and I got a feeling it's a more accurate gauge than your traditional polling methods. So I don't know how you build a narrative out of that. But I don't know if anyone inside Toyota has been looking at that aspect.
Why did you say it was more accurate?
Pardon?
Why did you say that what the response you got you feel is more accurate than a standard?
Can I say that?
Yeah.
Right. I don't know if it was more accurate. It might be more honest, I think, than the way traditional polls are done. I don't know. It was different than what you saw. The reason is it was different than what I saw coming out of polls. And you look at how the questions are asked in polls. Sometimes they're leading. I don't know. More accurate is probably the wrong word. But to me, it was a different response. And I got, you know, a couple thousand responses to this. But it was just interesting that some people felt, no big deal. If it's that easy to fix, no big deal. And part of the world thought, oh my God, Toyota's done for. This is their demise. It's about time. We're sick of them. Right? And then there were some people that had a completely different view, and it was really, really strange that way. I didn't see that in any of the polls, so
So Toyota essentially lost control of their cars, and you could also argue if they lost control of the story. Mm-hmm. Once you lose control of the story, can you get it back?
No. Well, what do you think?
I think when it's a runaway train, like this one is, it's probably very hard.
Yeah.
But I wonder with an organization that big, with which you're familiar, if you think it has the capacity or the will to regain it, given the way it works.
And I'd love to be inside to know what those stories are right now. I would love to know, because all we see is what's in the news. All we see are the PR folks that are doing a dance. All we see are some certain leaders that are being put on the spot, and if you look at what they're saying, it's not encouraging. And so now those stories start getting told. When your American leader here in the U.S. looks essentially like an ignoramus in front of Congress, that's not a good thing, and the stories start being generated. And that's exactly what happened. And that brings down an organization. All of a sudden, they're thinking about their organization in a way other than this story of how Toyota began, which was in spinning and weaving, and you stop whenever there is something wrong. I haven't given enough thought to the actual storytelling part of all of this.
Yeah, part of the problem would be that they haven't actually conceived of it as a story yet. My colleague and I, we do a lot of corporate storytelling. One thing we find is that people view a problem like this as just that, a problem that you solve with PR or media spin, and you don't recognize that a true story has problems. And you can, once you build on that, recognize it, then you make yourself more human. And that's what Toyota's doing a very bad job of right now, is portraying themselves as a human organization.
Yeah, I don't know if it's enough to just simply apologize. Mm-hmm. But how do you tell a story if there's no resolution to the story that people would buy. That's true. They don't know. So it's very difficult to craft a story when you don't know what's causing the primary conflict in the story. I don't know how you do that. Yes, sir.
Why do you just tell a different story? I mean, look what Exxon did after the MLB. They didn't keep trying to tell that story to make it better and make people accept it. They went back to other ethics
to the people past and started talking about those stories. The Chevron people do from the story.
You mean sort of replace it with, or divert attention?
It's called lines.
It's called what?
It's called lines. I mean, the question that I was going to ask is, you know, what becomes the dominant story is what sort of frames everything and guides it. If Exxon tells a different story, you know, if you ask any 5-year-old, they would say, well, that's a lie. You know, I mean, they would say, well, they're telling their side, they're telling their story. But I think with regard to this Toyota, it makes me think Bill Clinton, during the entire Monica Lewinsky issue, what he did is he framed it in a very different way of what was important to the American people, and he, you know, came out on top. I mean, after all the incident, his approval rating shot up higher because what the American people believed was what was truly important. So I think that it, you know, what you create, I think what one creates as the dominant story has a lot to do with what credibility is, what the believability is, the actual sincerity that comes out.
But you remember what happened to Audi in the 80s? They almost went under.
Mm-hmm.
And it was essentially hoax, essentially fraudulent, right? And there was no truth to the story, but the company almost went under, which is sort of to your point. What do you do? I think the only thing you can do is to rely on the honest truth. And if you don't have the honest truth, and you can't say what the truth is because you don't know it yet. Given our media world and our Twitter world, we're going to fill in. We're going to fill in for you. And then the story gets told outside, and that's not a good thing. Other people tell the story. Steve.
Take two more questions.
Two more. How do we do this? You do it. I don't want us to laugh.
Go ahead.
Well, the predominant story that was told to everyone that came into the organization as a new employee. And there were two stories that were told. The primary story being how Toyota began, which was back in the late 1800s, when Sukichi Toyota was a young man of roughly 20 years old, living in a very rural community, in a very poor household, and he was slated to be a carpenter by his father. And he had a different idea in mind. He wanted to solve a problem. And the problem that he wanted to solve was a problem facing his mom. His mother, like all the other housewives in this very rural and poor village, brought extra income into the household by spinning thread and yarn up in the rafters of their very humble home into cloth so that they could sell it to the merchants in the village and bring extra income in. Well, what really disturbed him was the fact that she would spend 8 hours, 10 hours a day doing this on a hand loom, on a piece of equipment that hadn't changed literally in thousands of years. No one had raised their hand to say, we need a new way to do this. But what pained him was that she could work all day long and have to scrap all of her labor and material that she had invested her pennies in because a thread had broken. And she could not sell it to the merchant. And that was a problem that he wanted to solve. And this was a couple years into Japan's patent law being passed. He fancied himself as an inventor. He wanted to use his creativity and woodworking skills to solve mom's problem. It was a very real societal problem in that village. And within 2 years, he developed a foot-powered loom. And that doubled her productivity. Didn't solve the problem, but it got her there quicker. And she could produce more. But it launched an entire adult career. And at the very end, he found the elegant solution. And the elegant solution was an automatic power loom that would do what? Stop whenever a thread broke. And he developed that in the mid-1920s. He sold the rights to that to a European firm. He gave a million yen to his son, Kishiro. And this is a story that everyone knows. You can tell I'm very versed in it. And he said, son, here's a million yen. It's about $100,000 back then, a lot of money. You can do anything you want with it, as long as you start a car company. Toyota automatic loom works is still a going concern. The car company started in the Stump Works project in the corner of the spinning factory. He had visited the United States, saw the Ford Model T, thought that they had the capacity because they were building motors for their looms to build an engine, which is the heart of the automobile. And he died before ever seeing the car company formed. The car company got formed in 35, 36, 5 or 6 years after he passed away. But that's story number one, and the reason that that is a very powerful story is because it underlies a key principle of the core values of the organization, one of them being continuous improvement. He had hundreds of patents, and he was never, ever satisfied until he found that elegant solution after, 40 years of looking for it and developing and constantly improving things. But the other is the notion of jidoka, which is a Japanese word that essentially means stop when something goes wrong. See, he wanted the loom to stop when a thread broke, to save all of that waste. There's a huge inefficiency and huge ineffectiveness and huge waste. But that's one story. Right? The other story that's told is the story of the Noumi story that I alluded to earlier, where there was a GM plant in Fremont, California, that Toyota turned around, took over, became joint partners with GM in the early 1980s, basically because the government was sort of forcing some trade restrictions and turned it around. It's sort of why we know about Toyota in the first place and their methodology. Those are the two stories that everyone learns week one. They go through simulation to understand how the Toyota production system works, and there was an award-winning video done with Hollywood actors about the Sakichi Toyota story. They used holograms. It was very nicely done on a CD-ROM. This was 10 years ago when CD-ROM was cutting edge. But those are the two stories.
Take one more.
One more. Okay.
Working for a large government organization that maybe doesn't have innovation as its core competency. It seems that now what the tendency is in the government side is to contract out projects or ideas that require innovation. And I wonder what you think of an organization externalizing innovation and almost accepting and recognizing that that's not their forte.
I think when it comes to certain products and gadgets and gizmos, that may be a valued strategy. Certainly Toyota has external design studios that they own, but they're still sort of external to the organization. However, the everyday innovation is not something that you ever want to outsource. Otherwise, you become a shipping department. Right? You've got to build a workforce that believes that they can come in and look at a piece of work. If you can figure out a way to put a windshield wiper on a different way a couple times a week, there's something magical there. If you can do that there, you can do it anywhere. So the challenge is, how do you build that innovative mindset into an organization? I think what you're seeing now, there's sort of a management zeitgeist going on. I don't know if you've tuned into it or not, but it's called design thinking. Have you heard of this term?
Mm-hmm.
In the last year, a spate of books have come out. But the notion is that we probably have an opportunity to get the creativity and innovative mindset in simply by not using necessarily different processes, because human beings consciously solve problems really in just sort of one way. It's got four phases to it. The neuroscientists that I spend time with verify that. The other way is unconscious. It's when you wake up in the middle of the night and got that eureka moment. There's nothing you can really do to speed that up. The other way, the conscious, logical, when you try to blend some creativity in there, that can be tough. But sometimes the label we put on things gets in the way. You go to the bar and you say, gosh, I'm in charge of continuous process improvement in my organization. And, hey, I'm in charge of the design thinking group in my organization. Oh, really? That's kind of cool. But design firms have become the new management consultants. They're getting a lot of business. They're designing processes, services, and products. And the thought is, well, maybe there's an opportunity to bring that design thinking back. Because they don't do anything different than the shop floor guy at Toyota does, quite frankly. They investigate a problem. They come up with a hypothesis. They experiment, and then they adjust accordingly. That's the iterative loop. That's the problem-solving loop. That's the innovation loop. Right? I don't care what you're doing. That's the thing. So, in terms of government, right? Because I've worked with some government groups, I've worked with the Defense Department, I've worked with some paramilitary groups like the Los Angeles Police Department. If you can get those folks to be innovative in their job, right, with local autonomy, which is the key. The key is local autonomy. You've got to be able to innovate within your sandbox, right? Given your job, given your description, There's plenty of room inside that box to get better. There really, truly is. If you can get that into the government mindset, that's your way ahead of the game. So that you don't want to outsource. You want the next new fighter, you know, the bomber? You might need some help doing that. Because it's not like you want the executive assistant designing your next new product. That's not her talent zone or his talent zone, right? But you do want him or her coming up with new processes for that executive suite that make things a little bit more less burdensome for those that she serves. So I think that's a win.